This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, this is David Rutledge. Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. Great to have your company this week for a conversation about a way of approaching gender, particularly transgender, that is philosophically very interesting, but also politically very useful. Because in case you haven't been paying attention, the politics around transgender these days is just horrible, particularly in the USA, where my guest this week is situated. So just a few quick facts to begin with. Over the past 12 months, more than 500 pieces of anti-LGBTQ legislation have been introduced across the US. 20 states have banned healthcare for transgender youth. There are various bills that restrict which public toilets trans people can use, bills that restrict trans people's participation in sport, bills that require teachers to out any of their students who they think might be trans, bills that allow state authorities to remove trans kids from the custody of their parents. And it's important to note that not all of these bills have been passed and that there is vigorous resistance being mounted against these attacks on trans rights. But, you know, things are not good. So I'm talking this week with Robin Dembroff, who's an assistant professor in the philosophy department at Yale University. And for some years now, Robin has been one of the leading figures in feminist and LGBTQ philosophy. They've been writing recently about the ways in which transgender is commonly understood as an identity, commonly understood as something that comes with certain definable identity characteristics, and that we all agree on what those characteristics are or what they should be. But Robin Dembroff is more interested in looking at transgender as not being about identity, but more about a certain kind of experience. And we'll get onto that a little later in the conversation, after some discussion about the problem that philosophy has with transgender. I want to begin, I suppose, with a bit of context, because we're having this conversation at a time when fundamental protections for trans people are coming under direct, sustained attack in the USA. And of course, this is happening in other places as well. But America seems to be way out in front when it comes to really, you know, focused legislative attacks on trans rights and the rights of sexual minorities across the board. Can you give me a sense of what that's like? Like how you're experiencing it as a trans person yourself, but also how it seems to be playing out in broader cultural terms? Like how hard do you have to look to find just anti-trans messaging, anti-trans discourse just out there in the community?
Yeah, well, for myself personally, my experience of what's going on right now is deeply informed by my historical awareness of the ways that these dynamics have played out so many times in the past. The doubling down on heteronormativity happened, you know, in the 1930s during the Great Depression. It happened in the 70s and 80s. It happens every time wealth disparities get really great and there's a huge amount of economic pressure that, you know, the corporate powers that be, in my book, I'd call them real men, but the elites don't want people to focus on economic inequality. And so they often distract them with lines that feed into fears about sexual anxieties and about identity anxieties, about race, about gender. And so for me, seeing that this is happening right now in this moment, of course, as a trans person, it impacts me personally, but I also know that I'm at a moment that so many people historically have been at before and that they have lived through. And knowing that they have lived through it, knowing that I am here today in a world where I am able to be myself in a way that I wouldn't have been able to be myself 50 years ago, it gives me hope, even though things are, you know, pretty dark in a certain way.
What I've been noticing in the media that I consume about trans experience in the USA right now is that it's pretty much all bad news. Like you really have to go looking for information about signs of hope, signs of effective resistance. It's just wall-to-wall moral panic and the abuse of trans rights. Am I getting a biased perspective there?
Oh, you're definitely getting a biased perspective in two senses, both because there are many states that are going the opposite direction and they're passing protections for trans people. They're in expanding health coverage for trans medical care and things like that. But even within the states that are passing this kind of legislation, the most powerful pushback is coming from, you know, Gen Z. It's coming from young people who are doing school walkouts. They're doing protests at state capitals. They're doing grassroots organization that isn't being reported on as widely as it should be. And I think, you know, there's, I'm sure, reasons why that's being ignored by people who control the media.
You've been writing about how transphobia is evident in the academic sphere, indeed that philosophy has a transgender problem that is in some ways particular to the discipline. What is that problem and how does it manifest itself?
Philosophy as a discipline relies a lot on two things. The first thing is epistemic authority, because we're not a field that has empirical evidence. It's based on rhetoric. It's about your arguments making sense to someone else. And we know that when someone's arguments make sense to someone else, there are a lot of social factors that influence how authoritative that person is heard as being. So I think that those kinds of social factors have influenced the perspectives of particularly powerful white men in our field who have tended to not be as friendly to sexual minorities, including trans people, but certainly not limited to trans people. But the second thing is that, and this is closely related, the field very much relies on arguments that appeal to common sense or that appeal to what's so-called intuitive. And if we step back, what's intuitive to one person might not be intuitive to another, and what's common sense to one person might not be common sense to another. When you put those two things together, what you end up with is a field that is predominantly following the common sense of people who have stood atop social hierarchies with respect to the wealth and resources that they have had access to. And those people, again, tend to be conservative is a euphemism for it, but prejudiced against sexual minorities.
Right. And this, you say, is related to problems that philosophy has traditionally had with race, with class, with disability. What's the connection there?
It's the same dynamics that play out over and over again. You know, I think that it used to be common sense that, for example, Black people were considered to be lower on the scale of evolution than white people or less civilized than white people, or common sense that women would hurt their bodies by having higher education. You know, these kinds of things that to us seem ridiculous today were common sense to the very same demographic of people that still run the field.
And presumably we're talking analytic philosophy here, first and foremost, as opposed to continental philosophy. I'm not entirely happy with those two demarcations, but that's what we seem to be working with.
I'm primarily in what some people call analytic philosophy. I don't really understand. It seems like people have different distinctions they're pointing at when they use those terms. Sometimes they're talking about method. Sometimes they're talking about what literature you're talking about. Sometimes they're just talking about what figures do you consider yourself beholden to. But I don't think that, you know, a problem with integration or diversity along sexuality and race, these are not problems that are unique to analytic philosophy.
Yeah. Well, you've mentioned that philosophy has this sort of methodological reliance on appeals to common sense. What sort of cisgender common sense assumptions do philosophers typically make, and what sort of pronouncements stem from those assumptions?
I think the main common sense assumption that they make, which is one that are made by a lot of people who haven't read a lot about, or maybe thought a lot about, the gender concepts that they're bringing to the table, is just that it's a obvious, common sense matter of fact that all human beings are divided into two types, men and women, and that those categories can just be taken for granted in social interactions.
Right. But as you've pointed out, the methodology of transgender philosophy is out there in the world. It's increasingly mainstream, like queer philosophy, like feminist philosophy. These are established disciplines, and I wonder why professional philosophers aren't better acquainted with them. Because generally speaking, if a philosopher wants to make some sort of public statement about Kantian ethics, they're going to make pretty sure that they've read the literature, otherwise they're going to look stupid. Why doesn't this motivation apply to trans philosophy, do you think?
I think the notion of common sense probably comes up in spades here. Most people wouldn't think that they can, just by appealing to their own common sense, come to some sort of truth about what Foucault or Kant or Plato meant in a certain dialogue. But they do think that they can just introspect and come to some kind of common sense truth about the realities of gender. They don't consider gender a social phenomena in the way that they would take many other phenomena to require serious empirical and historical study.
And do you think that this has to do with analytic philosophy's I won't say aversion to social and political issues necessarily, but a conviction that these things lie outside of the domain of philosophy, which is supposed to be abstract and conceptual first and foremost? Or is it more a sort of a squeamishness about transgender in particular?
I don't know that it's a dichotomy there. I mean, certainly a lot of philosophers, you know, Bertrand Russell, even Socrates, deeply embedded in political activism and in speaking truth to power in certain ways and being very actually not abstract and engaging in detail in social and political issues of their day. That said, you know, I agree that philosophy tends towards conceptual issues because philosophy as a discipline is very focused on developing conceptual frameworks that help us approach problems, think about what the meaning is of our lives, think about what we think exists. But I don't think that coming up with conceptual frameworks in any way carves out the social and political. I think that's just a matter of the discipline's history. You know, it's a discipline that hasn't attracted people who are under material duress. Philosophy is kind of a leisure activity, and in certain sorts of ways, it's an activity that most people are under too much pressure to pay their rent and, you know, take their kids to school to be able to spend a lot of time thinking about these more abstract questions. And I think the fact that the discipline is that way, as well as, you know, the fact that that always reinforces itself, the history of the discipline for hundreds and hundreds of years has put primarily forward the voices of the most privileged people.
In your paper on this, you've written that culture's prevailing hermeneutical tools were not designed for those who are compelled to follow their internal compass deep into the territory of gender deviance. Is the really problematic hermeneutical tool here the insistence on conceptualizing in terms of binary oppositions? Is that sort of foundational in some sense, do you think?
I think the fact that gender is understood as a binary is important, but I would say that for me, I think that the even deeper issue is that the binary concepts that we have conflate three things. It conflates the body parts that someone has with how they are perceived and treated by other people, with how they understand themselves and the desires that they have about how they want to live their lives. And we conflate those three things together with our understanding of men and women. And we also not only conflate those three things together, we conflate ideas about what is with ideas about how they ought to be. So it's not just the idea that males are masculine. There's this secret. Is or ought to be. It's kind of both, that males are masculine, but oh no, if you find one that's not, he better be, right? So there's a lot that gets conflated within our gender terms. And I think that's for me, that's the biggest problem.
Well, you've written this really interesting paper titled Reimagining Transgender, where you're looking to shift the focus from trans identity to trans experience. You write that there certainly is such a thing as transgender identity, but not all who share in transgender experience share in transgender identity. And while no one is perfectly gender conforming, not everyone has transgender experience. That's a dense little formulation, but really it's, you know, everything we want to talk about is there. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important for people to recognize that human beings aren't split into this binary of trans and not trans or trans and cis. We all are people who are existing within societies that label our bodies and put certain expectations on us based on those labels, based on how other people see us and based on how we see ourselves. None of us perfectly live up to those expectations. All of us, in some ways, break those expectations. And I think most of us, in certain, maybe small ways, sometimes intentionally break those expectations, right? We know that one thing's expected of us as a man or as a woman, but we don't do it because it doesn't feel good to us or because something else would feel better to us. And when I talk about transgender experience, I'm talking about people who, from their own will, from their self-propulsion, break the rules of gender in pursuit of a kind of ease and pleasure and ability to be in their bodies and in relationships in a way that's life-affirming, in a way that really severely breaks those expectations and rules and creates a lot of backlash against them.
It's, I guess there's a challenge here for you as a philosopher, insofar as philosophy generally likes to delineate the boundaries of whatever's under discussion, likes to define necessary and sufficient conditions for being this or that. Your approach to transgender makes that traditional approach very difficult, if not impossible, it seems.
I think that the necessary and sufficient conditions approach is one tradition within philosophy, but it's certainly not the only tradition. And I also don't think it's a very, in my view, it's not a very compelling tradition. As soon as you provide necessary and sufficient conditions for a category that all of our categories are constantly being negotiated and renegotiated through language, through social practice, all these things. And when you pretend that they have firm or universal boundaries in this way, it immediately just creates these huge literatures. And I'm not guessing here. This is in fact the case. It creates these gigantic literatures of people just counterexampling each other, being like, well, here's a slightly different way of drawing the boundaries based on this case. And here's a slightly different way of drawing the boundaries. I don't think that's very interesting. I am more interested in getting underneath those arguments and instead talking about the experiences and relationships and social structures that give rise to our concepts of these categories.
On Radio National and the ABC Listen app, you're listening to The Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge, and my guest this week is Yale University's Robin Dembroff. We're talking about transgender experience and how experience provides a better way of thinking about transgender than identity categories. If we reduce transgender to transgender identity, or we assume that transgender experience is always experienced by people who identify as transgender, what are we missing? Like, what sorts of exclusions happen as a result from that?
The most important exclusion I think that we miss is that there are many people who are gender nonconforming, who choose to lives of gender nonconformity in very significant ways, who experience many, if not all, and sometimes more, of the same costs as people who would explicitly identify themselves as transgender or use language that would identify them as a different category than the one they were assigned at birth. And those people, the people who don't explicitly identify as transgender, but are nevertheless very gender nonconforming, those people are also impacted by the social stigma, by the discriminatory legislation. All of these attacks on trans people are not just attacks on people with transgender identity. They're really attacks on people who are choosing to live lives that don't conform to gendered expectations.
And what's interesting is that what you're advocating here is actually not new. You say you're looking back to an earlier meaning of transgender. Tell me about that. I find that really interesting.
Yeah, the original notion of transgender as it was developed within queer communities was meant to be an umbrella term for everyone who, I think Susan Stryker's language for it is, was moving away from their designated gender designation. That's not an exact quote, but that's the feeling of the quote. So it was always meant to be a really inclusive term that was intended to draw together the group of people who experience a lot of social stigmatization and harm because they visibly or in other kinds of obvious ways choose to not obey the gendered rules, the gendered laws of society, and they experience the similar kinds of discrimination as a result of that.
Right. And I guess what you're articulating there is something that recognizes diversity within transgender in the same way that we talk about recognizing diversity within gender itself. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's no accident that these anti-trans laws are getting passed at the same time as anti-drag laws are being passed, right? Drag queens also are examples of people who, whether or not they identify as trans, some do, some don't, are people who are very openly defying the gender rules. And that's what's really at issue in all of these legislative campaigns and these hate campaigns is really about doubling down on heteronormativity in all of its forms.
But if we take the view that transgender signifies gender nonconformity rather than any sort of definable identity, potentially that broadens things out to where almost any of us can say we're transgender because there would be very few people who conform perfectly to gender norms. Is that a problem?
Yeah, I want to draw here a parallel to the way we talk about disability. So similarly, I think we talk about disability, there's no hard line in the world between bodies that are disabled and those that are non-disabled. And, you know, different people have bodies that work in different ways. We all have different bodies that are differently capable. But nevertheless, that doesn't mean that, you know, just because I have a twinge in my hip today, I should go around and say I'm disabled, because that carries a certain kind of social connotation, social significance, because I'm claiming that I have experienced certain kinds of stigmatization and harm that give me a right to sort of center myself in at least in a moment as speaking for a certain kind of community. So I think that similar with transgender, we are all gender nonconforming in certain ways. And if someone thinks they're not thinking hard enough, right? Like, think a little bit harder, you'll find a way that there's something about you that's not living up to some ideal you've internalized of what you should be as a man or what you should be as a woman. But that doesn't mean that you should go around saying that you're trans, because similarly, when you say you're trans, you're saying that you have had certain kinds of experiences of discrimination and harm, or are likely to experience certain kinds of discrimination and harm because of the way that you're positioned in the world. One other thing I want to say about that, though, is that one thing that's really important to me in moving to this notion of experience is that even though I think that not everyone is positioned in a way where they have the standing to claim transgender as a term that describes them, I also think it's important for them to recognize where they are on the spectrum of transgender, not to other transgender people as, you know, those are people who are just fundamentally different than me. They're not fundamentally different than you. They're just people who, in order to live their lives feeling like they're being themselves, in order to not be dissociated or to not be depressed, in order to experience joy in all of its fullness, need to break more of the rules of gender than you do. Or maybe don't, and you just haven't figured it out yet. It's also possible.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this brings up the notion of willful divergence from gender norms that you write about. And you say that transgender specifically emphasizes that notion of willfulness. What's the significance there?
It's really important to me that we recognize that there are many ways to be gender nonconforming that are not chosen. In our white supremacist, you know, capitalist societies, ideals of gender build in your access to capital. They build in your race. You know, for example, think about beauty norms. Beauty norms create of masculinity and of femininity often are norms that elevate bodies that are white, that elevate people who have access to very expensive procedures and beauty products. Similarly, you know, within masculinity, norms of being a breadwinner or being able to provide for a family privilege those who have access to economic success, which is, of course, very tied up in race and being part of a historically privileged group. And so I think my point in dividing willful or kind of self-directed nonconformity from other kinds of nonconformity is that when we have ideals of manhood or ideals of womanhood that elevate people on the basis of whether or not they belong to historically privileged groups, someone can be gender nonconforming in the sense of not meeting a prejudicial ideal just by virtue of being a person of color or just by virtue of being homeless. But that doesn't mean that that's self-directed. You know, that's an imposed form of gender nonconformity.
So what you're talking about then is a sort of, well, as you say, you're not talking about just a mismatch with gender paradigms. It's a kind of defiance, if you like.
Yeah, I think that, you know, for me personally, it has a good helping of defiance built into my experience of it. For others, it's not coming from a place of defiance. It's just coming from, you know, for some, it's coming from a place of desperation. For some, it's coming from a place of seeking authenticity or self-expression. You know, the reason why trans people or people of transgender experience pursue gender nonconformity can differ across different people. But I think for all of us, what holds us all together is that we choose it. There's a kind of self-directedness because we're going after the kind of life we want, even though that choice comes with costs, social costs.
What you're saying puts me in mind of something that, you know, you hear a lot from well-meaning people, particularly talking about, you know, gay and lesbian orientation, which is to say that they can't help it. It's something you're born that way. It's innate. And as I say, it's often well-meaning, but I always sort of find it troubling because people also talk that way about people born with serious disabilities. You know, it's an appeal for pity in the face of a kind of helplessness. And you write in your paper about defiance, gender defiance, as opposed to helplessness before our own sexual and gender orientation. So is that, I mean, do you sort of have that in mind as well, that sort of assertion of self over against this idea that people are just sort of innately gay or lesbian or trans or queer?
Yeah, I really want to distinguish here between desire and pursuing desire. I think that most people don't experience the desires for the kinds of relationship that they want or the kinds of clothing they feel comfortable in or any of those things as chosen. Those, you know, they're socially formed, but for many of us, our desires are not explicitly chosen. But what I do think we all have agency in, whether you're trans or not, or gay or not, you know, all of us have agency in how we choose to pursue our desires or not, and the risks that we're willing to take in order to actualize ourselves in the world, even when it's, you know, society is telling us not to.
Tell me about cost, because that's something that plays into this as well. You know, gender deviance, apart from willfulness, there's also this sense of a cost. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, for me, going back to what I was saying earlier about how, you know, for example, if a straight cis man wants to paint his fingernails, you know, maybe in some places he would experience severe costs for doing that. But at least where I live, it would be like, if anything, kind of cool. Like, oh, you're breaking gender norms in this, you know, subtle way that makes you cool in a certain way.
It's kind of metal, isn't it?
Yeah. But having transgender experience, I think, is something that requires a lot of bravery in our world, especially today. And it's important to me that, you know, I hope that maybe this isn't part of transgender experience in the future, but at least right now, it is a part of transgender experience that when you pursue a life that breaks gender rules in these deep ways, like, for example, by wanting to present yourself with clothing that signals to other people that you have different body parts than you in fact have. You know, that's not your fault, but our society is set up in a way where doing that is seen as a bad thing. For someone to be able to move through the world and feel comfortable in their skin, they might need to take those costs. And I think it's important for us as a society that hopefully wants to create a world where people can feel comfortable in their skin without taking on those kinds of severe costs. We recognize that some people have costs for their gender nonconformity and other people do not.
But doesn't the emphasis on costs and consequences potentially give support to an anti-trans perspective that might say something like, okay, so if suffering goes with the territory, then transgender experience is essentially unhealthy or even self-destructive, and here you are admitting it.
It's so funny. That rhetorical move has been used against people seeking their own liberation so many times. You know, white supremacists said the same thing about enslaved people wanting to break free of slavery. Patriarchs said the same thing about women wanting higher education. You know, in all of these cases, they said, oh, well, you know, if you do that, it's going to be bad for you. It's going to mutilate your body. It's going to ruin your life in these or that ways. And so I think that we need to learn from that history when we hear this rhetoric. Seeking a gender nonconforming life for trans people is entirely about seeking a life of happiness. And the costs that come along with that are not because of them. It's because they live in a world that's hostile to the having a diversity of forms of happiness.
There's a question I have here, though, about the demarcation of boundaries, maybe is the best way of putting it, because I think what you're outlining here is really interesting. It's politically useful, but what would your response be to someone who said, well, what you're doing here is sort of laying down normative criteria for transgender? A person should be gender nonconforming, their nonconformity should be willful, and it should carry some form of cost. Those are the three boxes that you have to tick. Presumably, I mean, you're not about ticking boxes, but what is, you know, is there a sort of ambiguity here, I guess, between that freedom and a certain boundary demarcation?
Yeah, it's important to me that I'm not trying to do boundary demarcation. What I'm trying to do is describe a phenomena that's been at the heart of the concept of transgender since its invention, and one that I think is particularly useful for us who want to pull the curtain back on this anti-trans discrimination and legislation and stigma and show that at the heart of it what it's about is imposing heteronormativity on everyone, right? It's really about regulating and policing people by the rules of a gender binary, regardless of whether or not they identify as trans or not, regardless of whether they are significantly gender nonconforming or not. And so part of that for me is it's a practical project. It's a political project of trying to raise awareness about this phenomenon. What I'm not really interested in fact, I'm not interested in at all, is going around to people and saying, well, you may not claim the word transgender because I don't think you've willfully enough, you know, been gender nonconforming. That's not at all something I am interested in. I'm not interested in policing boundaries.
Robin Dembroff, Assistant Professor in Philosophy at Yale University. And the paper that we've been talking about in this interview is titled Reimagining Transgender. It's really, really good. You can find a link to that and a number of other excellent pieces on Robin Dembroff's website. We'll put a link on the Philosopher's Zone website. And this has been the Philosopher's Zone. You can find all of our past programs on the ABC Listen app. I'm David Rutledge, and I hope you can join me next time. Bye for now.